Like to call Hess Committee to order at this time. It is 1:35. We have all members present except Senator Dyson, who's out of state for a conference. I have present Senator Elton, Senator Cowdery, and Senator Thomas, Vice Chair, and Betty Davis. We do have a presentation to come before us today, and we're very pleased to have Mary Thompson in our midst today. She's going to be introduced by Walter Majoris. I'm going to ask him to come up. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Walter Majoris, and my role is as the president of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. And the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, in combination with the Alaska Associations of Homes for Children, are very proud and pleased to bring Mary Thornton to the state of Alaska. And for anyone who doesn't know, Mary is the country's leading expert in terms of behavioral health as it relates to the federal Medicaid program. And I had the honor and privilege to attend a training that Mary put on in Phoenix, and when I heard her presentation about the various changes that are happening in the federal Medicaid program and as it affects behavioral health, it became really clear to me that this was a message that many more people needed to hear in the state of Alaska. So we brought her up here. She gave a presentation yesterday to 90 people from around the state down at Centennial Hall. And today we had a follow-up meeting with about 20 people, including behavioral health providers and representatives from the Department of Health and Social Services, to talk about, now that we've heard this information, how are we going to work together to be able to address these very important issues. So all that being said, I'm very proud to introduce Mary Thornton to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to say to you before she starts her presentation that we appreciate you, that you would allow her to come and speak to the legislature. That's quite generous of you, and we appreciate that a lot. I also want to recognize that our representative, Sharon Sissner, is in the audience. You may come up and have a seat here. You passed. Is there anybody else in here that I should be recognizing? I don't have any glasses. I can't see well back there. I don't want to miss out on anybody. Okay. All right. And I'm sorry that I mispronounced your name. I thought Thompson, but I look at the paper, it's Thornton.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Mary, you're in charge.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you and the other senators about what is happening at the federal level with Medicaid and some of the changes that are anticipated. The first thing, which is, I know everybody knows this, but it's every once in a while it's a good thing to remind yourself that Medicaid is a shared cost. And because it is a shared cost, there are two opinions, really the state opinion and the federal opinion, on the quality and the content of services. And what has been happening lately in behavioral health has been quite a big divergence between what the states are saying are covered and high quality services and what the federal government believes are covered and high quality services. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that at the federal level, the focus right now is almost only on cost savings. And you are seeing, for the first time this year, the cost of Medicaid cross Medicare in terms of total costs. And as a result, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services and its enforcement and oversight arms are really going in with much narrower definitions of services than they have in the past. And they are really emphasizing a medical model after spending quite a bit of time through SAMHSA and other policy initiatives at the federal level of really trying to steer behavioral health into the areas of wellness and recovery as opposed to a medical model. The federal frustrations really sort of boiled over after a number of government accounting office audits of the Medicaid program and the kinds and types of risks that existed within the Medicaid program, including fraud, abuse, and also improper payments, not having nothing to do really with fraud and abuse at all. they really felt that the fraud efforts were really uneven at the state levels, and it was very frustrating to them that they couldn't have more say and more of a oversight function at the state levels. And they felt that what happened was is that the states would determine for themselves how much emphasis they wanted to put on program integrity, and that, in fact, in most cases, the investment in the investigative arms at the state level were inadequate. They were also frustrated about the fact that Medicaid is a state-by-state program and that the rules are different on a state-by-state basis, and they had hard times sort of trying to figure out whether or not practice patterns and differences in them and differences in costs had real meaning in terms of quality or were just differences in how the states were managing the integrity of the programs. They felt that what was happening at the state levels to a greater degree than they originally thought was the medicating of services. And by that I mean states were taking services that had formerly been paid for by state grants, changing slightly the definitions of services, and then pushing them under the Medicaid umbrella. Okay. And that, they felt, had really resulted in quite a significant rise in the cost, in particular, of behavioral health services. So I'm going to talk about five areas where I'm seeing fairly significant changes in the federal way of doing things that I think will have an impact on behavioral health. And the first one of those is the new auditors. PERM and the DRA and the RAC and all of these different sort of audit functions that now exist at the federal level, many of them are really new. And as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act, have hundreds of millions of dollars invested in them in order to be able to produce more savings in the Medicaid program through audit and other kinds of oversight activities. Okay. There is an increased pressure as a result of this at the state level. So the state is going to feel quite a bit of pressure to increase its own audit and investigative activities as well as a result of the new auditors that Medicaid has put into place. So if you look at the chart up there, what you have are the auditors that are sort of the federal responsibility auditors and then the state responsibility auditors. And the whole landscape is really changing around audit functions. Alaska will undergo its PERM audit in the next year, from what I understand, and the PERM audit is set up to develop an overall federal error rate for the Medicaid programs. And what will happen is that error rates that are greater than 2.5% in any one state will be sent to Congress as part of a report card for the state and its ability to manage the program integrity of the Medicaid program. So those PERM auditors are going to be in 17 states at a time, and it's going to be a rolling audit that will be continuous. Every 3 years, those PERM auditors will be back in the state of Alaska. In addition, they've developed this Medicaid Integrity Program, which is going to have private contractors hired by the federal government looking at both what's going on at the state level and the state activities, and also going around the state directly to providers. This is something new. Usually, you see the audits that are coming out of CMS going through the state, looking at the state and the state's management of providers. You don't generally see the auditors going around the state directly to providers. So that is something that's very new and something that the state can't really protect its providers from. On the state side of things, the federal government is pushing the states to adopt a False Claims Act very similar to the federal False Claims Act, which has a lower level of intent and has whistleblower provisions in it, including the provision that whistleblowers will collect a piece of whatever is recovered by the federal government. This will allow the Medicaid fraud control units to have access to both civil complaints as well as criminal complaints. So it will increase activity there. And again, I think you're going to see more and more pressure on the state Medicaid agency to beef up its program integrity activities. Okay. The return on investment is expected to be really quite high. So the federal government has generally stated that they get somewhere between a 25% to 35% return on their investments, and they're expecting the same kind of thing with these investments. The total investments as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act are well in excess of $200 million a year, focused just on Medicaid integrity. I'm sorry. So the first thing that is really changing at the federal level and that is going to be felt at the state levels are these new auditors. The second thing that is happening are the new rules. Now, in your packet, you have a New York Times article, a recent New York Times article, about the Governors Association meeting and really being up in arms about new rule changes that CMS is proposing that they think represents a very significant cost shift away from the federal government and back to the states. On the behavioral health side, what we're seeing is a new rehabilitation rule that will cost shift quite a few, hundreds of millions of dollars away from the federal government and its Medicaid costs into the child welfare programs that are funded by the state. The new rehab rules will significantly reduce the kinds and types of services that can be provided to the seriously and persistently mentally ill, especially on the adult side of things. And so one of the things that the governors are concerned about from the behavioral health arena is the institution of this new rule. They have a moratorium on the rule until the end of July, but after July, nobody knows what will happen with it. The other big rule change that they have done is the case management rule. The targeted case management and case management rule. The federal government pays quite a bit of money, quite a bit of match for targeted case management, and they are very concerned about the kinds and types of services that are being provided under case management. You should know also that this won't just affect behavioral health. Targeted case management groups include the developmentally disabled, the elderly that are frail, pregnant women. There are lots of different targeted groups in the state of Alaska and in many states that will be affected by this rule as well. And then finally, in terms of new rules, in a fairly typical federal way, they've got the SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Authority, issuing a number of evidence-based practices. With the assumption that Medicaid would actually cover the cost of those services. Unfortunately, recently, CMS came out with sort of an encyclical on the evidence-based practices in mental health and really restricted the kinds and types of services within those evidence-based practices that Medicaid will actually cover. So you're seeing rule changes that will really have a huge impact on the way that services can be provided in behavioral health. So you can see the expected outcome from just the rehab rule alone was supposed to be over $2 billion from 2008 to 2012. And those savings are going to come primarily from children's services. With the shift, a cost shift into foster care costs and into residential costs that are the responsibility of the state and away from the costs that Medicaid has been paying for to date. In particular, in terms of non-covered services, they are targeting therapeutic foster care, regular foster care services, child caring institutions, and other kinds of activities that have been considered to be rehabilitative to date, but that Medicaid is now drawing a bright line between those services and the services that Medicaid will pay for. So what you're seeing in some states that have been under pressure from CMS is the delinking, rather than the integration of services, the literal delinking of services from one another in rehab. On the case management side, the savings are expected to be about $800 million a year, although the governors have really disputed that figure. They are saying that the savings that the federal government will get are way in excess of that amount, that they really underestimated the additional costs that the states are going to have to cover. Again, many of these savings are going to come from shutting down certain kinds and types of children's services. Okay. And in particular, one of the things that the case management rule emphasizes is that the case managers are simply there to link people to services, that they're not there to really provide the kinds and types of assistance we're used to seeing in case management services, where they can be involved with the family and can really provide not only just the telephone numbers and the appointments, but the real support people need to link to services and to stay linked to services. The new definition is really quite restrictive. There's only four different things that people can do. And I'm not sure if anybody's seen it, but in Massachusetts, where I'm from, we recently were told that we have to pay back $87 million of $104 million we billed in case management services because we did not meet this much stricter, newer definition. So the potential paybacks are really quite huge with the rule changes. So to suggest that the savings are going to only be $800 million when Massachusetts alone is going to come up with one-eighth of that, really, I think, underestimates the impact on the states. The evidence-based practices in terms of behavioral health and their impact there have really had a big impact on the ability of states to target families as a treatment entity. Right now, Medicaid and Medicare both work from the position that the services are provided to an identified client, and they must be exclusively directed to that identified client. And if they are not, then Medicaid won't pay for them. So some of the intensive home-based services and other kinds of service delivery systems that have proven to be a best practice with some evidence behind that are going to be really impacted by the inability of a provider to actually target a family, but only individuals within that family. The other thing I think that is important in terms of the evidence-based practices is that for many in the adult systems, the targeted outcome, a recovery outcome, is actually helping the individual get back to work so that they can be productive part of the community and can be more well integrated into the community. Medicaid is also saying that it will not supply any funding for supported employment activities to help individuals get and keep jobs. This oftentimes is really problematic in behavioral health, especially with the seriously mentally ill, because even though there are voc rehab dollars, those voc rehab dollars are really limited in scope and don't provide the long-term support that many individuals need to be able to keep the job that they've gotten. Okay. So the second issue is, in addition to the new auditors, there are the new rules that are coming out that are having a big impact on the financing of healthcare in the states. The third issue is the recreation of silos, where Medicaid is suggesting that it does not want to be part of an integrated system. It wants to be able to see its own services. So, for example, in New Mexico, a really quite wonderful children's integrated service delivery system was developed, where all of the buckets of money went into one place and were doled out as the child needed them, as the child or the family needed them. Medicaid at the last minute pulled out of the integration and required that rather than it being an integrated system, it had to be a braided system so that Medicaid could see exactly how its dollars were being spent. So what you're seeing now in the new case management rule and the rehab rule as well is Medicaid pulling back from the idea of integration. So what they said is, in the case management rule, for example, is that they expect the Title IV-E money that Alaska gets to pay for all of the case management services that the children in protective custody get. Normally what happens in many states is that you have a caseworkers with fairly high caseloads, and the mental health caseworker comes in from the mental health system to provide case management and case coordination services for the seriously emotionally disturbed or the seriously mentally ill. That will no longer be possible under the new rules. So you're going to see your foster care and child welfare service dollars need to increase in order to cover the gap in services that will exist with the new case management rule. So that's one of the areas where they're creating a silo. The second area where they're creating a silo is with parole and probation. They are saying basically that Medicaid and the parole and probation systems must be delinked, that parole and probation and the criminal justice system has its own dollars for health care, and that Medicaid cannot be used to supplement those. The most recent example of that was in Georgia, where they literally took apart the entire children's residential system because the system was being partially paid for by the juvenile justice system and partially paid for by Medicaid. And what Medicaid said was is that a child, regardless of whether they volunteered or not to go into residential services, if they were in there serving out the remainder of their sentence, that they were considered to be incarcerated and were not eligible for any Medicaid at all. Okay, so they've had to entirely revamp that system as a result. So again, another impact of the case management rule. A third area is public guardianship. In many cases, especially with the adult mentally ill, the behavioral health providers are oftentimes in the position of having to make and help people make decisions about their health care. Medicaid, again, is saying that they will not pay for any of those services either. The services that a provider might give to an adult in helping them choose the Medicare Part D program that they need to be involved in or would like to be involved in, helping them make health care decisions and other kinds of things, Medicaid is saying it wants to be delinked from that. With special education, Medicaid did allow for certain types of case management activities that were ordered as part of an individual educational plan to remain in place. But they put strict limits on those. They can't include any kind of administrative work, but they are allowed if the IEP orders a service coordinator or if the individual family service plan orders a case coordinator, Medicaid still will allow its dollars to be used for those individuals. So that's the third thing that is happening, is the delinking of Medicaid from these systems that really have a big impact on behavioral health care. You know, the ties that Alaska has built on the behavioral health side with the juvenile justice system has really resulted in reduced costs, deferred, you know, incarcerations, and all sorts of other really wonderful benefits that will be lost if those kinds of linkages can't remain. Okay. So in Massachusetts, for example, they denied a service where a case manager accompanied a child on a court visit because they said that was acting as a court advocate and not as a case manager, even though the child would have had nobody else to go with them if the case manager had not done that. The fourth thing that they're doing is they're reasserting old rules. As I said earlier, they really are focusing a lot on this whole issue of family treatment. Where they are saying that the family is not an entity as far as Medicaid is concerned, that you must treat individuals only. They are also looking at specific and effective parenting treatment. So one of the things that they have denied recently is any kind of education that helps parents learn to be parents, no matter how chaotic or how problematic the parenting has been in terms of its impact on the child. But general parenting, they say, is not a cost of the Medicaid system. It is a cost of the public health system, the child welfare system, other kinds of systems need to come in there. On the medical necessity side of things, that has always been really problematic with behavioral health because we rely so much on our documentation, they really are trying to implement, I think, some new rules that will make it more difficult for providers to engage clients in services because there is not the time available to be able to, for the client and the provider to get to know one another enough so that they can make decisions. So, for example, in Texas, they have a recovery goal system like Medicaid is now trying to sponsor. And what happens is that the client meets somebody for the first time. They do this assessment, and then the client is told, you know, based on this assessment, we think you need to be seen 5 times a week. And what the client says to this perfect stranger that they've never seen before is, no, thank you. And so now Texas has resulted in a system where very few people are getting the kinds of care that they need, and they're actually having to mandate a mandatory visits on the part of providers because they've had such a difficult time getting people into services. So I'm really concerned about the medical necessity rules and the recovery-based goals that they are talking about. The final issue within the reasserting old rules is the IMD issue. IMDs are institutions of mental diseases. It's a horrible name, but it is something that has been around for forever. And basically what it says, these rules say, is that an IMD is any kind of institution with more than 16 beds that's primarily engaged in providing diagnosis, treatment, or care of individuals with mental diseases. And that includes substance abuse problems as well in the mental diseases. Okay. They also go on to say that if a facility is an IMD, that Medicaid will not pay federal financial participation for anybody between the age of 21 and 65 in an IMD. And for those individuals who are 21 and below, it will allow Medicaid coverage for the cost of inpatient services only. The children are not covered for medical, dental, or any other services other than the inpatient psychiatric when they're in the IMD. Medicaid has said that it will only pay per diems for services that are actually your level 5 services, the highest level of psychiatric residential treatment. And so because of that, states are really trying to figure out what to do with the residential service programs. They know that these children need treatment. But as soon as they bring treatment into the residence, Medicaid begins to make noises about whether or not the residence is an IMD. And therefore the children shouldn't be covered for medical and dental and other services. And so there's a tug of war around payment for these places. What you have in many states, and I think in Alaska also, is some fairly substantial campuses that have been built, and it were built when these providers were providing only child caring services. So these were for protection and for the safety of children. Then at some point in time, many states understood that many of these children had serious emotional disturbances or mental illness as a result of the abuse that they had experienced. And so they brought treatment into the facilities as an efficient and effective way of making things work. Well, now on the other side of that, Medicaid is saying if there are more than 16 beds, then Medicaid is going to cover only a very limited benefit, and only if you have certain medical and other staff on board, making the services much more expensive. Okay. So the residential rate setting is becoming problematic in many states as they try and figure out how to tackle this issue of how to provide residential services that are treatment-oriented and meaningful, but don't require a level 5 status in order to get Medicaid reimbursement. Okay. In New York and Virginia, there have been a number of audits, and in one case, the New York audit went to the appellate court, and the appellate court upheld federal Medicaid's position on IMDs that, in fact, the psych under 21 benefit really was only for inpatient services. So states are really trying to scramble to get an idea of how exactly to reconfigure residential services so that they're not left with the full payment of these services, and that Medicaid is paying its share. One of the things that I did with providers in the past couple of days is went through a set of guidelines that's been developed by the state of Georgia after it had its children's residential programs really taken apart by CMS. And basically what they have done is tried to provide some advice to organizations about how to keep campuses, to divide those up into distinct parts that are distinctly licensed and have distinct populations that they're serving, or distinct ways of treating populations, in order to try and keep the federal government from glomming all of the beds together and making it an IMD by counting all the beds. So this is a tough issue that a lot of states are beginning to tackle. The results have been really quite varied, but it's a very serious one, and there's huge amounts of money associated with whether or not the facility is considered to be an IMD or not. Okay. And then the final issue that I wanted to deal with you on is the whole issue of unbundling. And that is that Medicaid is saying that it no longer wants to pay for per diems or monthly rates or any kind of case rates at all. It wants to see each and every service that it is providing. So in behavioral health here in Alaska, you have a service called BRS services, which I can't for the life of me remember what the BRS stands for. But This is a daily per diem that providers earn in residential facilities that allows them to bill for, you know, one claim that includes multiple services that are provided throughout the day. What Medicaid is saying is that they want those services unbundled. They want to see every single service separately documented, which increases the administrative costs tremendously without really having any kind of impact at all on the quality of care. Okay. Other than the fact that you're going to have a lot of people who would otherwise be interacting with clients sitting around trying to fill out their medical records instead. So unbundling is an issue in the state of Alaska in behavioral health, but my understanding is also in other areas where the bundling of services has been done and is going to have to be unbundled in the future. So, for example, what they say in the case management rule is that a state cannot employ a methodology or rate that results in payment for a bundle of services. So per diems, monthly or weekly payments are not allowed. And that's because Medicaid doesn't want to pay for anticipated services. They want to only pay for actual services. And they suggest that a 15-minute unit of service would be an appropriate one. So they want to see services laid out, including, you know, 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-day services laid out in 15-minute increments. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which creates huge problems. So now what needs to be done? Well, the awareness at the state level of the potential impact is really incredibly important. This is not a time to sort of turn away and wait for things to happen. And Alaska, the people that I've met with in the past three or four days have been really incredibly interested in trying to work together with the legislature, with the provider community, with the consumer community, to try and look at the impact of these potential rule changes and other things going on at the federal level with the Medicaid programs and the services that are being delivered. There needs to be a lot of support for providers. There needs to be a rewriting of many of the provider manuals to take into account some of this new information. And there needs to be a lot of technical assistance given to providers to help them sort of work their way through these things. It would be incredibly expensive if each provider had to sort of figure their way through this maze on their own. They really need sort of a statewide effort to try and make sure that this happens. And there needs to be continued legislative advocacy. Continuing to tell the federal senators and representatives that these rule changes will be devastating to the state, that the cost shifts have been really underestimated and will really be quite significant unless something is done with the rule changes.
Oh.
I know.
That's a lot.
Good idea. Yeah, Mary Sunshine, right? So
I was just thinking while you were going through all this, when you had your meeting yesterday, were there people from this division present, Medicaid folks?
Yes.
And they were?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they absolutely. Were.
And
in fact, we had actually a smaller meeting today, and there were many representatives from the division there this morning, too.
Okay, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of these things, all the terms that you have in here, a lot of our people would know, because there are some on here that I don't know. Mm-hmm. I suppose that we have the terms around here and address with, but the unbundling, I know that we do bundling.
Yes, you do.
When do you have to stop doing that? Is it already in place, or is it going to happen later?
Right now with unbundling, the position that the federal government is in now with the case management rule, which requires unbundling, the interim case management rule actually went into effect yesterday, but there's a lot of work going on at the federal level to try and create a moratorium on the implementation of that rule, hopefully until 2009. But it's tied up into a law that President Bush has already said he's going to veto, and so nobody's really quite sure what the outcome of that will be.
As of today, we are out of compliance if they don't pass the moratorium.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And
now,
We
don't know if they will. States will be given some time to change their state plans and to take a look at what they've got on hand before they. Before I think that there will be any kind of takebacks or anything like that, but it really is one of those situations where nobody really knows what's going to happen. And the because it was introduced as an interim final rule, there really wasn't the time for public feedback and that kind of thing that normally happens with something that's as significant as this. And I don't think that many people expected that the case management rule would include sort of extraneous things like this unbundling stuff and other kinds of things. You know, we thought it would deal mostly with just the definition of services because that seemed to be where they were heading. But there's all sorts of other things included in it, including all this delinking from child welfare and parole and other kind of stuff that came in as a result of this rule.
I do know that we have been audited at least once. I don't know more than that, but they have. You said they come every 3 years?
Yeah, you're going to have the PIRM auditors, which is they're just looking at the Medicaid error rate. Mm-hmm. The PIRM auditors are going to be here, I think, in the next year, developing that rate. But in addition to that, there are the Office of the Inspector General auditors and then these new Medicaid Integrity Program auditors that will be coming to the state at some point in time. I think they're being organized in a regional way, so at some point in time they will come to Alaska.
So and the burden of all that is on the states to pay, or is it federal paid, the auditors?
The federal government is paying for all of these auditors, but the expectation is that these auditors will return quite a bit on the investment. So the Medicaid Integrity Program is being funded, at almost $100 million, I think, this past year, and it's going up from there. They expect to get many more dollars back than they're investing in these programs.
I would suppose if with the change of administration, there's a possibility that a lot of these things could be looked at again and revamped and not have to do some of the things that we are doing or getting ready to do.
a lot of people are hoping that will happen. What I don't know, the case management definition is in law, so they'd have to actually change the law to do something like that. But they could make the rules less onerous for the states. And I think that that's what people are hoping. I'm just not really quite sure how far down into the bureaucracy all of this goes, you know, and whether or not, if the rule changes go into effect, how fast they can be changed.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm glad you said wow first, because I was you're talking rapidly and
I know,
maybe
I'm
it's
sorry.
Just my brain not able to comprehend all of that, so hopefully we don't have a quiz here at the end of the day. But it seemed to me that, you know, auditing is all well and good to and I realize you're just the messenger, but auditing is all well and good, and I'm sure there were many people within the system here in the state that would suggest that things be done differently. But in my limited knowledge, just looking at what was presented here today, it doesn't appear that was even the goal. My reaction to it is that it doesn't appear that the goal was just to revamp the system and improve things and look at some ability to making a system more efficient, and obviously there may be things that somebody would say have to be done, and others maybe that are in the system would say no. But I was just wondering when the audits were done, do you have a sense for, and I'm probably not asking this very well, do you have a sense for what input and what took place after that, or did the auditors simply go back, most likely, as it appears to me, with a goal in mind of saving money, and come back and say, this is what we need to do, and we've really not considered, or did they actually sit down and consider all of the suggestions that may have been made by the people in the various states as to what should take place?
It doesn't seem to me that with the rules, the way they turned out, that they were taking advice from anybody that actually operates, in the behavioral health arena, because some of the stuff that they have suggested is really almost operationally impossible. You know, you'd have to have a supercomputer in order to figure some of the stuff out. So I don't think that they did that. I think that what I've seen of the audits is that oftentimes it's the only information we get from the federal government about what they like and what they don't like. And so most providers are watching the audits, you know, always trying to figure out what's okay and what's not okay. But what happens is that if an audit comes up with a surprisingly high error rate, then all of a sudden that becomes sort of the focus of a number of subsequent audits as they look at it, and then subsequent to that they start making rule changes in order to be able to try and control what they consider to be unexpected costs. So in rehab services and mental health, the cost of those services was more than was expected around the country. And so they sent in a couple of auditors. There were a couple of bad audit findings. And as a result of that, the rule changes happen. Case management, it's the same thing. You know, Massachusetts, where I'm from, you know, $84 million payback. Maine, I think, just had to pay back almost everything it billed for targeted case management services. And I don't think that really has to do with the fact that the providers don't know what they're doing. It's just that during these periods of time, they really narrow the definitions of what they're looking for and what they're willing to pay for or not pay for. So in Iowa, where they had one of the rehab audits that were done in behavioral health, all of those providers had been audited by the state prior to that and had not had a problem. But the federal government came in and used sort of a new set of rules about what would be covered and what wouldn't be covered, and it took both the providers and the state by surprise. So we're trying to sort of grapple with what meaning do the audits have in terms of how do we change our practice, or do we wait for the rule changes to change our practice? It's hard to tell.
While you were in your meeting yesterday, did you hear some of the providers talking about the problems that they are already having with the audits that have been, I'm sure that must have come up, because some of them have been fined a considerable amount of money for very small things that they have maybe not correct in there, but they said they are not being able to pay that because it was money that they didn't foresee that was going to have to be paid back.
Right.
So it's a big problem. So that had to come up yesterday.
yes, the providers did talk about the audits that they're experiencing now because they wanted to know whether or not they could rely on the audit findings in the face of a federal audit. And I think that that's mostly what we talked about was, you know, was the audit by the state rigorous enough so that we can feel comfortable that if we came out okay on the other end, that we'll come out okay in a federal audit. I don't really know the answer to that because I haven't seen any of the audits that have been done. I know that Alaska is a cutting edge in terms of you do extrapolated audits, you know, meaning that you actually do random samples and and extrapolate across the entire population. That seems to be the direction that many states are moving in order to be able to have the funding available should there be a bad federal audit.
I know that some of the members got some other questions, but I'm going to ask for Walter Majoris to come back up, please. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I... you saw the need to bring an expert in and have your workers trained and have other people be able to come to the conference that you had. Would you like to share with us some of the concerns that you had?
Sure, Madam Chair. And while I was listening to Mary talk now and as well as the presentations that she's given here in Juneau and other parts of the country, there are a couple things that are coming to mind now. Just to illustrate as examples, you know, and some of it gets technical, and I'll try to be non-technical, but the area that I think I'm most worried about is, well, the audits, because there are just so many, and I think the goal is not to be kind and friendly, but to figure out ways to just get, you know, big paybacks, you know, so I don't think they're particularly interested in the quality of the services. I think, like, you know, it's way of getting back monies. But the other part that I'm really concerned about is reinterpretation of old rules, and I'm just going to give one or two examples, and the one that I'm really concerned about, and I'll give the example of my own agency, is the one that's called an IMD, and very simply put, that if you provide, you know, mental health or substance abuse services in a residential or institutional setting and you have over 16 beds, then it's not reimbursable for federal Medicaid. Okay, now I'll give the example of my organization at Juneau Youth Services, is that partly because of, you know, that rule, all of our facilities are less than 16 beds. But as an agency, we have 54 beds. Okay, now my understanding of the new rules, and in fact my understanding is that CMS personnel have been in contact with Alaska about this already, that in any given day they can say that Juneau Youth Services and other organizations that provide children's residential services, because we in total provide more than 16 beds, that there is no federal reimbursement for any of those services. So they can tomorrow, literally tomorrow, say to the state of Alaska, we're denying all federal participation for residential services being provided for Juneau Youth Services. I mean, that alone is millions of dollars just from my agency. You know, and that can literally happen tomorrow, and it probably will happen tomorrow, because, as I say, CMS is already for a year or two now been in dialogue with the state of Alaska on this issue. So I'm very, very nervous about this reinterpretation of old rules.
Yes, Senator Elton?
Thank you. A couple of questions. And normally I begin my questions by saying thank you for your testimony. I'm not sure I'm prepared to thank you. But maybe depending on the answer. This is extremely disturbing, and I guess I'm looking for a little bit of advice, not just for the legislature, but maybe for the agency also. Is there a state out there that has put together a good program to review how to deal with this coming tsunami? I mean, is there some place we can look to and say, okay, this is a good first step for us, and we've got to be quick. You mentioned Georgia, but I mean, who do we look to for a model for this?
I don't think that there are any models at this point in time, Senator. I think that all of the states are trying to figure out what to do in the face of all of this, because this is really new stuff. This is, you know, this is something that is just being funded. This Medicaid Integrity Program with all of these dollars and stuff like that is really, really brand new. I think that if I was going to go to anybody for advice on what providers should do, one of the people that I would talk to would be Jim Sheehan, who is the the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General for the state of New York. He's a very, very well-known healthcare prosecutor that has moved from a federal position to a state job. A very, very high level of visibility, and he's a really, really nice person to talk to. So he's somebody that I think could help providers begin to figure their way out of it. But I think that what needs to happen is just what we did today, which is we made a list of priority items. They have to be super prioritized because, I mean, the list was too long to deal with everything at once. Timeline needs to be put together, and you need to just go after them one by one by one.
And Jim Sheehan, the New York office of...
He's the Medicaid Inspector General for the state of New York. Okay. He's the OMIG.
And
now you spell it last name?
S-H-E-E-H-A-N.
And Madam Chair, another question.
Yes.
And either Walter can answer it maybe based on kind of what could happen locally, but you may have some experience of what has happened in other states. I mean, I'm anticipating with this... all of these new audits, including one that I find disturbing, the Bounty Hunter one. In fact, is that something I'd want to consider doing? It sounds to me like it could be very lucrative.
Well, if it is really, really quite disturbing what they've done with these RAC auditors. They're recovery audit contractors, and they come out of the Tax Relief and I forget Health Care Act. Which I never heard of before in my life. But these auditors literally go out there and they have access to, these are the kinds of contractors that have access to software that can filter huge amounts of data. Mm-hmm. So they take the publicly available data on the Medicaid program and they look for aberrant practice patterns. So they say, well, in West Virginia it only costs, you know, $500 a year for services, but in Alaska it costs $10,000. What's the difference? And then they go up there and they're allowed to look. And the reason why I call them real bounty hunters is because what happens is that they can request that you make paybacks, and the provider does have to pay back. The provider can appeal, but even if the provider appeals and wins, the RAC auditors get to keep their money, the percentage that they earned. So there's no real incentive to make sure that they've got a good, solid case, you know, before they go in there and try and do something. Now, they're Medicare only at this point, not Medicaid. Okay.
Well, given the RAC auditors and all of the others, I mean, I'm assuming, Walter, that your administrative costs for the agency skyrocket as you go through audit after audit after audit. And maybe that assumption is wrong, and maybe there is experience in other states that maybe Mary can speak to.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'm very concerned about that issue, and along with that, I'm very concerned about the difference between the state audits and the federal audits. And again, I think the best way to address that is to give an example. Our agency has had the distinct honor of being chosen for 3 years out of four for one of these Myers and Stauffer, you know, state audits, and we've had two of them, and the third one is sort of on hold right at the moment. And in the first two of those state audits, and these are audits where we have submitted literally like 11,000 pieces of paper along with the audit to justify the services, because in behavioral health, you don't just have to show the service was provided, you have to have a comprehensive assessment and a functional assessment and a master treatment plan and a quarterly treatment review and a progress note, and all of those have to be linked together. So the two state Myers and Stauffer audits that we went through, we scored 100%, zero error rate. Now, in talking to Mary Thornton, you know, if the feds came in, that doesn't mean that you're held harmless. I mean, they look at it totally differently. They get down to a total level of the quality of the documentation, and not just whether the documentation is there or not. And so we could score 100% on a state audit and have to pay 80% back on a federal audit. So that's the part that really makes me nervous, besides just the tremendous amount of additional administrative work to make sure you're doing the best that you can, but it's the different standards that are applied to a federal audit versus a state audit.
You got a plate full.
Administrative costs are going up for organizations because they are having to deal with, they have to have compliance programs now. Those are mandated for certain providers that bill Medicaid over certain amounts of money. And in order to reduce risk in the organization, they have to have internal auditors and internal quality assurance stuff far beyond what they used to have to before in order to ensure that they can pass a federal audit.
Any other questions?
Sounds to me like the revolution is the only answer.
Alaska Independence Party.
You know, I suppose as a HESC committee, we'd be concerned about this. I would like to know from the members here if we want to. I know that we got a lot to do in 90 days and can't take on a whole lot of things, but at least by the time we get out of here, when we have some free time, we need to get with our Medicaid division and just have them come and tell us exactly where we are and where they think they're going to be and see what's done. I know there was some inspection going on. There was some audits that was been taking place, have been taking place. I think there was a contractor was supposed to be working with them because of some of the Medicaid problems.
Yeah, Madam Chair, at your pleasure, there are representatives both from the Division of Behavioral Health and the Medicaid division here in the audience that could speak to some of your issues.
Why did you not identify yourself, folks?
Walter's show.
Oh, no, it's going to be your show also. I didn't see you back there. I told you I couldn't see.
For the record, Jerry Fuller, Medicaid director. What you're hearing today has been on our radar screen for a couple of years. We've submitted state plan amendments around rehabilitative services in the past, only to hit a brick wall with CMS requiring us to change everything that we've been doing. And so we've pulled back the state plans rather than completely reconfigure our system based on a state plan amendment, not based on regulations or statute or anything else. So currently, our focus, and this is a great presentation that Mary's done the last 2 days, but my focus, the department's focus, has been working with our delegation to put the kibosh on these regulations. National Governors Association on Friday or Monday sent a letter to Secretary Leavitt and to Congress basically saying, you know, this is too much. And in addition to the targeted case management and rehabilitation services, it's another 5 regulations that also have negative impacts on the department, not to the degree that the rehabilitation services regulation does, but administratively burdensome, impossible perhaps to administer. So our focus has been at the federal level. Our delegation is completely apprised of this. When a moratorium language for the targeted case management was added to the Indian Health Care Reauthorization Bill last week or the week before, it was a unanimous vote in the Senate to add that. So there is some political momentum back east to put a kibosh to all of this. Monday of this week, the House Subcommittee on Government Reform and Oversight published a survey of all of the Medicaid programs in the country. CMS, in their testimony to Congress, said that these 7 different regulations were expected to save the federal government approximately $15 billion. So this committee, Representative Henry Waxman, surveyed all of the states and got the estimates from the state Medicaid directors. And lo and behold, if you added it all up, it was closer to $50 billion from the state's perspective. Now, you can argue, is it 50 or is it 15, but it's all a cost shift to state general fund, assuming that the legislature would backfill the hole that this will create, at a time when Congress is talking about economic slowdown, economic stimulus packages to help the states out. So there's a tremendous amount of interest in D.C. Now, whether it will, you know, come to fruition in terms of a moratorium or some other type of delay, it remains to be seen. Congress will have a bill that they must pass before June 30th, and that deals with Medicare and dealing with anticipated or the fact that Medicare practitioner reimbursement will drop 10% unless they act. They did a temporary extension back in November or December to get it out to June 30th, but it's a bill that they must pass, and the president, whoever the president is, must sign, or the Medicare program across the country is in great trouble. That will be a vehicle that Congress, if they so choose, could tack on some language for a moratorium or, you know, however the proper wording would be. So we've been focused on that aspect as a department and myself. In addition, the CMS auditors, who isn't in the room today, has been reviewing Walter's operation and others around the juvenile justice services, around this institution for mental disease definition. We've been working with them to help these two auditors understand what the past CMS policy pronouncements have said, reminded them that they haven't superseded or eliminated any of these past documents, trying to help these guys understand that by their own writing, what they're doing, it doesn't comport with regulation or what they've said in the past, which may not stop them at all, but we'll build our case for the legal process if we have to go that far. So yes, there's a lot of money at stake for Alaska, particularly around the residential services for juvenile justice and Walter's entire system and others, but it's premature to really know how it's all going to play out. That's why I haven't been banging at your door to raise the alarm, because we don't know how it's going to play out at this point.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, one of the things that I just want to be really clear about is that the issues around the rule changes are one issue out of five big things that are going on at the Medicaid level. And so the fact that there's a moratorium on the case management rehab rule actually probably won't diminish the risk that the providers are feeling by much, because they are already auditing to the definitions in the rehab rule and the case management rule, and those have passed, and the states have not been able to win in those situations. So I just want to make sure that that's in perspective. And I think that what Medicaid is doing here in this state is wonderful. I mean, they really are on top of it, whereas I've been in some states where they don't really even know at the state Medicaid level, you know, how to begin to deal with this. But I just wanted there to be perspective on this.
Yes, Senator Elton.
Thank you. Well, maybe things are out of perspective for me at the moment, and maybe I'll come to grips with it. But a question for Jerry, I guess. I mean, given what's at risk on just this one component that we had the presentation on today, I mean, given what's at risk, I mean, do you have a team working on this? Do you have a person or people working with other states to try and coordinate a message? Do you have attorneys reviewing, you know, some of the interpretations on old rules and potential new rules? Do you have a kind of a coordinated effort with others, so that we have kind of cohesive arguments that talk about what real impacts are? And if not, do you need a team of people? And if you do need a team of people, how much is it going to cost? Because I'm concerned that what happens is, with the magnitude of the potential problem, we either need an answer now on whether we need to beef up our efforts, our outreach efforts to Congress and to the rulemakers, because I mean we don't get back together until next January. To help deal with the issue. I'm a little bit concerned that if we wait to see what happens, when it happens, we won't be ready for it.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I agree completely. As far as the team, there's two or three of us within the department. They're quite focused on this. We're in contact with many of the other states to find out what's occurred. When the CMS auditors have come in. I'm personally trying to work with the National Association of State Medicaid Directors and American Public Health Services Association and NGA to get it on the meeting agenda that's coming up, so that we have a cohesive approach to the next administration, so that they can understand what has occurred over the last 8 years, and whoever the candidates are can be positioned to move in whatever direction they so choose. Perhaps being optimistically foolish that it will be a different direction. In addition, a lawsuit was filed on Monday by four states. We may or may not join into that. waiting for the AG to make a determination, but it's a lawsuit against the federal government, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service, to do an injunction for the targeted case management regulations. That's organized through a D.C. law firm, Covington and Burling, that we use constantly to deal with our appeals, deal with the legal issues. So that in, you know, 2 minutes is what we're doing at that level.
Madam Chair, just to,
yes,
I mean, it would be interesting, I think, if we could get a copy of the lawsuit, and then perhaps if the department could, you know, give us some kind of an indication of the arguments that they're using, because I do think that quite a few of us are members of NCSL, and there are other avenues that perhaps the legislature can supplement the efforts of the executive, and so the lawsuit and
yes.
other information would be helpful.
Yeah, consider it done, Senator Elton.
Are there any other things that you want to share with us that we might need to be working on or have a good understanding of?
Well, as you've heard all of the acronyms and terms, I think this is a good first blush. It's, from my point of view, I've dealt with this kind of thing over the years, nothing to this magnitude, but, you know, individual audits or unusual interpretations that come out of the blue from the federal government. And so maybe I should be more anxious than I am, but you know, I only woke up at 2 o'clock last night thinking about it, so it's not too bad yet. So consider this, I guess, forewarned. And by all means, if you would like more information during the adjournment, during the course of the summer, if something comes up, we can, you know, keep you all apprised in whatever manner you'd wish, because we have to deal with this together.
Yes. Any further questions? And I'd like for you to come back up. Yes. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask if it would be okay with you. The director for the Division of Behavioral Health is here, and I was wondering if it would be okay for her to say a few words about her perspective on these issues.
Well, certainly. I would love to have her say something.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Melissa Stone, Director of Behavioral Health. Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the providers coming together and bringing Mary Thornton to the state. I think it's been very informative for us all. I think it's been a real opportunity for us to hear information together and strategize together, providers and state, and I think that's really imperative at a time like this. I believe that we certainly share extreme anxiety, and we are also resisting a reaction that could cause us more complications because we realize that we have an existing system that we need to be supportive of. At the same time, we look to the future at how we might need to change that. So we can't abandon what we're doing at the same time we look to the future at how we need to change. A concern in that for all of us in behavioral health and for the providers is the magnitude of that problem, of course, to be doing everything that needs to be done for agency readiness, audit, risk management preparation, both from the state perspective in terms of staff to be able to do those kinds of preparation and technical assistance to our providers, and for the providers to have the resources to be able to put their own teams together to constantly train and constantly review their records to see that they're in compliance. So on the short term, your question about what can we do, what we need to do, that's our biggest challenge right now, is the resources at the state level and at the provider level to protect what we're currently doing. At the same time, we're very cautious and aware of the impact of these changes at the federal level and how our system needs to change in response to those. One other piece of that that we talked about this morning that I feel strongly about is the integrity of the clinical system that still needs to be intact. We're talking a lot about the reimbursement of the system, and we haven't really said anything about the quality of the system or the content of the system. So we need to not leave the people that we're serving behind as we have this conversation. This is about, you know, behavioral health services to people in need, and yet that is not a lot of the conversation. So how to make sure that that remains our focus, and yet we can still afford to provide services is, I think, a very big challenge for us. And I don't say that we have answers, but I think we have the, I think we really have a commitment to work together to do what we need to do.
Is there any money in the present budget to help you in any way as far as more staff?
We have no money in the existing budget increments for
the FY09. Budget that we're working on now, your 09 budget.
We have no increments for admin services. There are increments existing right now for Medicaid rates.
Yes, I understand
which would help providers. And I, frankly, I'm not sure where the increments are right now for the GF part of the budget, which covers the non-Medicaid portion of services. So the rates, that rate is very important in relation to this problem, which is currently, I believe, at 8% increase for behavioral health.
Is there anybody else in here that wants to speak to the topic that we're on? Yes, Senator Elton?
Just a thank you. I mean, I appreciated your bringing us back around to the clients of this, because I assume that if we take tens of millions of dollars out of the system, there are clients that are going to fall out of the system. And perhaps one of the, just a suggestion, it's off the top of my head, it may be helpful to bring in some people that can do an assessment of how many people do fall out of the system, and if they do fall out of the system, what the cost to the state will be in the future. I mean, that's the kind of data that you can use as you're making your presentation to our delegation, or that we can use making a presentation to NCSL or whomever.
Okay, thank you very much. And back to the presenter, we appreciate you being here, and
thank
the
you
information
very much
that you provided us is very helpful to us, even though it it's not good news, but we do need to know the bad news too. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
And if there's no other person to speak to us at this time, we'll adjourn at 2:45.